Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
You are.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When officials at Lindsay Earls High School in Tecumseh, Oklahoma, told her she had to submit to a drug test to participate in after-school activities, Lindsay balked. She's a good kid, never even tried drugs, she said, and she was in the choir, for goodness sakes. Definitely not the leader of a school drug culture. She argued her case to the school board and eventually all the way to the United States Supreme Court. More and more, high schools are requiring their students to pass drug tests. First, they tested athletes. In 1995, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld an Oregon school's right to test student athletes. Since then, schools have expanded their testing to include students involved in extracurricular activities, students who drive to school, and some schools are looking to instate random drug testing of all students. The American Civil Liberties Union says the tests violate the Fourth Amendment's ban on unreasonable search and seizures. But school administrators throw up their hands and ask, what else can we do? How else can we keep the kids safe? Should America's youth be drug tested to play basketball, act in a school play, or park in the school's parking lot? Or is the war on drugs going too far? Have you been asked to submit to a mandatory drug test? Did it make you feel safer or violated? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined by Lisa Brady. She's principal at Hunterdon Central Regional High School in Flemington, New Jersey. Good evening and welcome, Lisa Brady.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for being with us. And also by our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, thanks very much for being with us tonight. Welcome.
Hello, Tom.
Lisa Brady, your high school is one of a number of high schools that reached out to institute drug testing and has since found itself embroiled in a lawsuit. Tell us, just so we understand how this is playing out on the ground, why did you reach to use this tool and what happened to you in the courts when you did?
Well, of course, we had been successfully randomly drug testing our student athletes for 3 years from 1996 until 2000.
Okay.
And our school board made the decision to move in that direction based on the Vernonia decision, of course, at the time.
And why did you, in practical terms, why did you do it? The Vernonia decision by the Supreme Court says you could do it. What was pushing you to do it?
Well, two things. We had just recently administered a survey to our students which showed very high areas and categories of drug use among our student population. In addition to that, we had...
What do you mean by high, may I ask, Lisa Brady?
Well, it depends on what you're looking at. The survey tested for in 28 categories of drug use, but we're looking at marijuana with students in grades 10 to 12. Over 10% of them had used hallucinogens. 12% of sophomores were using stimulants. 12% of our juniors had also used hallucinogens. 13% of seniors had used cocaine.
And what percent had used marijuana? I missed that number.
We had 48% of the kids who were smoking or who tried marijuana.
48% of the 10th through 12th graders in your
high
school.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And I have 2,500 kids in my high school.
Okay, so it's a lot of kids.
That's a lot of kids using drugs. On top of that, we had been doing what schools, I think, nationally are doing traditionally, things like student assistance counselors, augmented by guidance counselors or counselors in the community. We had brought in dogs that are available to schools through the prosecutor's office.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we had been running an under-suspicion drug testing program, which is required.
What does that mean, Lisa Purdy?
That means that if you thought that a student sitting in front of you right at the moment in real time is high, the law in New Jersey said that within 2 hours you have to test that student. So we had been using the under-suspicion testing program successfully, but based on the data which came to us through the survey, we realized that we still had a whole lot of kids who were using drugs.
So you felt like it was out of hand, the tools you were using weren't working, and you turned to random drug testing of athletes. Why drug testing and why athletes?
Well, at the time, because of the Vernonia decision, the only students that we could test legally were athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And drug testing, because it is a deterrent for kids, gives kids a reason to be able to say no. It's a lot easier at a party when you're 15 years old to say no to something because you're on the football team than it is to just draw on your own resources and to think that teenagers necessarily have the skills or are equipped with the wherewithal to be able to combat that on their own.
And Principal Brady, I want to make sure we know exactly what we're talking about here. Drug testing meant that the student athlete would be randomly selected, would be asked or ordered to give a urine sample, and that urine sample would reveal whether they had taken drugs during what previous period?
Well, it depends on the drug. Marijuana, as you may or may not know, can stay in the system for anywhere up to 30 days. Other drugs, like heroin, which is a drug that we have a particular problem with in Hunterdon County, have a shorter time span in the body. So it would really depend on what kind of drugs the kids were using. Mm-hmm. 30 days would be your long.
About as long. So you had a problem. Here was a tool. The Supreme Court only let you use it for your high school athletes. You reached out and used it. Did you have any hesitation about that?
We did not have any hesitation, but I will tell you that within the community in the beginning, there were a lot of concerns raised over the fact that we had decided to go out there and take what many people considered to be, especially 3 years ago, an extreme measure.
And what was the suit that came back at you, and has that closed down the program?
Well, what happened was in February of 2000, our school board, based on the recommendation of our drug task force committee, which was a committee of community people, students, parents, that committee recommended that we expand our program to include students in extracurricular activities and kids who were driving to school, based on the Rush v. Todd case, which had come down and said that we could do that. And we had heard a lot of most of the commentary from the community was not that they were against drug testing. Mm-hmm. They were against our singling out, what they perceived to be singling out the athletes. So when we were able to legally expand the testing pool, we did. Mm-hmm. And within that context, one of our students who was trying out for the school play was against the policy, refused to sign the consent form with his parents, was not allowed to participate in the play, and filed a lawsuit against the school. And in August of 2000, we were sued by the ACLU and three families, actually, in the school district. And we're right now on appeal in the appellate division in New Jersey with our case.
We're going to talk to an ACLU representative in just a moment. But let me ask you one more question, Principal Brady. If you could instate random drug testing of all your students, would you do it?
Absolutely, I would. And I make that point only because I feel that in a school, our obligation to make sure that we are providing a safe and drug-free school environment, in my opinion, supersedes what the ACLU will tell you is a student's Fourth Amendment rights to search and seizure, which is suspicionless. And there are a number of other things that are into play here. We are being held accountable for students' test scores. Teachers' professional lives are being tied to students' test scores. School districts are being funded often based on student test scores. Mm-hmm. So we have a right to know that when those students are being tested in our schools for academic purposes, that those students are not under the influence of drugs and alcohol.
Lisa Brady, you're giving us a vivid picture of what one high school principal is up against with this issue. If you'd be kind enough, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation Graham Boyd. He's joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. Good evening and welcome, Graham Boyd.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Graham Boyd, you argued Lindsey Earle's case to the Supreme Court last week. You're director of the ACLU's Drug Policy Litigation Project. You've stood up against the kind of drug testing that Principal Lisa Brady says would be really helpful to her, that she would do in a second if the courts permit her. Why do you think that it's wrong for schools to use drug testing of American students?
Well, I think to answer that question, you got to ask yourself sort of two different things. And one of them is it going to work? And the answer to that is, at least according to most of the experts, no. And is it legal? And the answer, in my view, to that is also no. So let me just start with, will it work?
Okay.
The American Academy of Pediatrics is you know, really the leading authority on children's health. That's what they do. Is try to take care of kids and keep them safe and healthy. And they've studied the situation. As it's been implemented in schools around the country, and you know, talking to doctors around the country, and they've come to the very firm conclusion that it's counterproductive to have drug testing policies like the one that I was litigating in before the Supreme Court.
And why? Why have they found it's counterproductive?
And the reasons, you know, it's on a couple of different levels. I guess the most obvious one is that the single most effective, proven way to keep kids out of trouble is to have them engaged in after-school activities. It's just a very commonsensical point that, you know, if you could choose for your own son or daughter that they be on a sports team or a school play or the debate club, or should they be hanging out on the street corner or, you know, playing Doom on their computer at home?
So you're saying
it's an easy choice.
You're saying if the students know that by joining an extracurricular activity they'll face a drug test, they're less likely to join the activity, and then they get into the wrong side of the tracks.
Exactly, and schools are really sort of misdirecting their energies in the pediatrician's view.
So that's the efficacy argument. Give us the legal argument. You're saying this is not constitutional in your view.
Well, it is. Let me add one other thing on the efficacy side, too, though, because the pediatricians, along with the social workers and teachers and drug treatment providers, also say that the limitations of drug testing that you were discussing a moment ago are very mm-hmm. important. It picks up marijuana fairly well. It does not pick up alcohol beyond a couple of hours. It doesn't pick up LSD or ecstasy at all. It can only pick up heroin after about 24 hours. And so it creates an incentive for students who want to experiment with drugs to use drugs that are more dangerous than marijuana, which is dangerous, increases the risk of overdose and death. And it also works differently than it does with adults. Adults respond to drug testing, according to the studies, more often by changing their behavior because of fear of getting caught. Teenagers are not like adults. Teenagers very often will say, you know, you want to try to catch me? Go ahead. I'm going to do everything I can to try to beat it. And it can lead to much more dangerous behavior on their part. So,
Graham Boyd, you're giving us the social psychology, but from the ACLU, we really want to hear the legal argument as well.
Well, I'm going to give you that, too, and here it goes.
Okay.
On the legal side, you know, the Fourth Amendment protects our privacy. It says that the government and a school district counts as government if it's a public school. The government cannot search any of us unless there's some reason to think that an individual has committed some wrong. And so I think most people know at a sort of intuitive level that the government couldn't send its agents through our neighborhood saying, we hear there may be some people using drugs here. We'd like to take a urine sample from everyone so that you can prove that you are not. That's not the way we do things. Mm-hmm. And the cases have been uniform literally since the founding of this country in that regard. Drugs, I think, have so panicked this society that they have been willing to bend those rules in sort of extreme circumstances. People who operate nuclear power plants, who drive trains, who carry guns, and also for athletes because of the dangers the court found in that. Singing in a school choir is entirely different. There's nothing dangerous about that. So if you combine the fact that it's not effective, it's not going to prevent any harm, with there's not a need for it because of safety concerns, there's just absolutely no justification for drug testing of a student who simply wants to sing in a school choir.
Graham Boyd, stand by. Lisa Brady, I know we're going to lose you at this first break. You've heard the ACLU attorney's argument, and he just made it recently before the Supreme Court, against using drug testing. Still, you're ready to do it. Do you have any concern about civil liberties issues here, Lisa Brady?
I do have concern about civil liberties issues, but I do not see them stacking up against the issues that we're dealing with every day in schools in terms of health and safety, in terms of what parents expect from us as school administrators as it relates to their children. I certainly understand the argument based on civil liberties, but I just do not think that it is that it passes the same kind of level that having to be responsible for kids' health and safety does. And I'd like to respond to a couple of things, if I could, quickly.
We've just got 30 seconds, so
okay.
Go for it.
We had no decrease in participation in our extracurricular program or our athletics over the 3 years that we had the policy in place. That's the one thing I wanted to make. Secondly of all, when we readministered our survey in 1999, 3 years later, we showed a dramatic decrease in the amount of drug use being exhibited by our students.
So, but your lights drug testing was working.
It was the only variable that had changed for us was the institution of the drug testing program. So we are pretty clear on the fact that the program was working, at least in my high school.
Lisa Brady, we hear your readiness to implement if the courts give you a green light. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Lisa Brady is principal of Hunterdon Central Regional High School in Flemington, New Jersey. We're talking about drug testing of American students. Should we just test all students for drugs? The Supreme Court will decide soon whether that path may be open. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about drug testing, about testing students in American public schools for illegal drug use. There's a big case before the Supreme Court now. They just began to hear it a week ago. But the movement to test students has been growing now for some years, and the permissions have been widening. What do you think? Would drug testing clean drugs out of American schools? Parents, would you feel better or worse if drug testing was widely used in your child's school? And students, is drug testing an answer or an outrage? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Graham Boyd, director of the American Civil Liberties Union Drug Policy Litigation Project. He argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court last week on behalf of a high school choir student whose school had a policy of drug testing of all students involved in extracurricular activities. And by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, you heard in the first segment there from a high school principal in New Jersey who, as she sees the world, is battling a wave of drug use, and this is the most effective tool she's found. She wants to use it. She wants the kids to be sober and educated.
Yeah, but educated in what? Justice Scalia, in his majority opinion in the Vernonia case, said that drugs were a, quote, life or death issue, and that tests were needed to avoid the danger of, quote, getting young people used to a drug culture. Well, we have to wonder, balance that against what kind of culture are we going to get them used to if we routinely subject them to searches whose nature is inherently degrading, that is to say, urine tests, and which are blanket searches. They're not warranted through suspicion. We're going to get them used to growing up in a world in which the Fourth Amendment really doesn't have much content. James Acton, who was the plaintiff in that case, said on the stand that suspicionless testing, which this would be, sends a message to children that they have to prove their innocence, and this is a bad thing for citizenship. And when he was asked on the stand, well, why did you refuse to take the test? He said, because I feel they have no reason to think I was taking drugs. Hmm. In her dissent in that case, Justice O'Connor said his answer resonates intensely with the tradition of the Fourth Amendment in America. So, yes, we may get people against the people get young people getting used to a drug culture. We have to wonder about young people getting used to a culture which systematically violates their rights and which teaches them that that essentially longstanding constitutional prohibitions on rights of privacy and so on are out the door because we have this crisis.
These are very, very tough alternatives. Graham Boyd, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're joined now by Julie Underwood. Julie's general counsel for the National School Boards Association. Good evening and welcome, Julie Underwood.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Julie Underwood, do you think that more school districts would test students if the Supreme Court upholds testing in the Oklahoma case?
I think that they would. I think that it would give them an opportunity to change the kind of surveillance, if you would, for drug use that they currently use now. I mean, there are some forms of school activity that I think that many people would prefer not to have happen, like routine random locker searches or bringing dogs in and out through school hallways. Those are searches that are currently going on in schools that may be on the decline if school districts had other things available to them.
You've followed this around American high schools. How widespread is the use of drug testing now in the United States?
Well, I believe it's about 500 school districts out of the 15,000 currently do some form of drug testing.
So this is way down in the single digits of percentages,
sure,
of America. Why do you think it's, what is that, 5% or something like that?
Well, I think that very few school districts use random drug testing because they're concerned about about this type of litigation. Mm-hmm. In 1995, the same Supreme Court that is currently sitting said that it was okay to drug test students who were involved in athletics. But they didn't go any further than that. There are some school districts, mainly in Indiana and Texas, that have gone further and have had some litigation on whether additional drug testing is proper. So I think it's really just being cautious that they haven't pursued it any further than they have.
So, but you see a kind of regional propensity to use drug testing?
Yes, I do.
What do you think that's about? Is this because there are more drug problems there or fewer, and they're allergic to drugs becoming more widely used?
I think it's because they're more, as you say, allergic to drugs being more widely used.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives them an opportunity to drug test students who aren't the general population of the school, but who want to be school leaders, who want to represent the school in extracurricular activities, and those kind of situations, rather than drug testing the entire population or subjecting the entire school to canines.
Julie Underwood, we had the impression at some point in the 1990s that drug use was falling in America's schools, and now I'm getting the impression people are saying that it's on the rise. Is that true? Do you have any numbers on that?
The National Center for Educational Statistics has numbers on that, and what you can see is reporting from school districts to the federal government. I'm not sure how accurate all of that reporting is. That was one of the questions that the Supreme Court had this last week.
Mm-hmm.
on individual school districts' drug problem. But we do know that we do have a national drug problem in our high school population, that it was on the decline, and it is now on its way back up. And school districts really are looking at alternatives, ways to combat this. And, you know, we also need to talk about and think about the constitutionality, because I think some of the conversation I would like to address.
Well, Graham Boyd, constitutionality is where you come in. You were right before the Supreme Court only a week ago. You hear Jack Beatty's concern that if we institute drug testing in the schools, there's a kind of education there that runs counter to the U.S. Constitution. Do you share that concern?
Well, I absolutely do, and I would say it goes even beyond just the issue of how school children are educated. The way the Fourth Amendment works in literally every context is it asks what is one's reasonable expectation of privacy. So if there's a future case about medical records or business records or snooping by the government into your and my lives, there will be a question of, well, what do people generally expect about their own privacy? And if drug testing becomes a rite of passage for an entire generation of students, and that's the threat here, then the collective expectation of privacy will be markedly lower. If giving a sample of your urine is part of growing up, then your ability to sort of say, well, I value my privacy, and the reality of your valuing of your privacy will change, and that is indeed a concern.
So, Graham Boyd, you're saying that a generation of Americans would lose some sense of what it means to be an American under the Constitution. In your eyes, Julie Underwood, what about that?
That comment's absolutely absurd. It doesn't look at the real reality of the constitutional analysis of individual liberties within the context of public schools.
What's your interpretation?
Students actually have constitutional rights, but they have a diminished set of constitutional rights. They don't have a full panoply of free speech rights, nor do they have a full panoply of rights under the Fourth Amendment. You can curtail student speech when they are in school, when they are in classrooms, when they are talking in any way that affects students or the school, and yet we have not lost a full generation's rights to free speech.
So the fact that I can ask a teacher can ask a student to come for detention doesn't mean that Americans welcome incarceration.
Exactly.
Well,
or the fact that we can tell students that they can't use obscenity in the hall room has not curtailed America's speech for over the last 20 years.
Graham Boyd?
I think there's a need for some precision here. What the Supreme Court has said is that students have the right, in terms of privacy, they don't have a right to require the school to go out and get a warrant, which is what you and I as adults have if the police or the government wants to search us. There is no warrant required, and indeed no probable cause is required in the school. But day in, day out, and indeed in all situations other than athlete drug testing, a school is required to have some measure of reasonable suspicion that the student has broken a rule. You can't have a blanket search. The only context in this country currently that all people can be searched for any reason at all is prisons. If this case is decided by the Supreme Court contrary to the position that I've taken, that would extend from prisoners to also include school students.
And that, in my mind,
is very, very serious in terms of lowering the expectations of privacy of a generation.
Julie Underwood, why do you think that's inaccurate?
That statement's inaccurate because what the Supreme Court has said in previous search cases within the school context is that it must be reasonable, generally reasonable, reasonable in its inception, reasonable in its scope. We do conduct random kind of searches. We have students walk through metal detectors. We do allow dogs up and down the hallway. Those are random, suspicionless drug searches.
Mm-hmm.
And the question of reasonableness does not mean that you have to have individualized suspicion for every student who is searched.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Paul Clement, the Bush administration's deputy solicitor general, said last week that he would agree the Constitution would ultimately permit all students to be tested. So a lot does seem on the table here. Julie Underwood, Graham Boyd, stand by. I want to bring some callers in. Anitra is on the line. Welcome, Anitra. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
I'm coming at this, I guess, from a little more personal perspective. I'm a first-year public school teacher. This is my third year of teaching.
Okay.
And in order to go into the school district I was going into, I myself had to get drug tested. And so I guess I'm just throwing out there as part of the conversation as, I don't know if to make the students themselves feel better or worse, but to initially be there in the public school, you yourself have to get tested. Now, I have other friends in other school districts that didn't have to go through this initial drug testing, but I tend to think if I have to do that to be there, I don't know why some of the students might not have to as well.
Well, it certainly has become part of the employment package in many jobs these days,
right,
that drug testing is part of it. Would you feel better, would you feel right if your students were widely tested for drug use, Anitra?
You know, it's difficult to say because I was at an alternative high school. I'm back in the middle school, and I'm going back to the high school again next year. So I guess I'm a little out of the loop in that sense. But, of course, you'd prefer to have your students fully engaged when they come to you in the morning at the god-awful hour that they have to come to.
Yeah, I'm sure they would. Anitra, good luck with your classes there. Jack Beatty, in the Supreme Court's hearing of this argument last week and the comments made there that have been publicly reported, what do you hear? Which way do you see the court leaning this time?
Well, I was really shocked, and maybe Mr. Boyd can throw some light on this, to the response of Justice Kennedy, who really said that the parents who assert their Fourth Amendment rights must be willing to send their children to, quote, druggy schools. And he sort of said, you know, you're the sort of parents who would do that. And, of course, that's exactly the kind of chilling assumption, as someone pointed out in a letter to the New York Times, that any parent would face who objected to this policy in a public meeting. What it would chill is the Fourth Amendment. And it really seemed, apparently his face was red. Well, perhaps Mr. Boyd can tell us about it.
What was the reception that you got in the Supreme Court, Graham Boyd?
It was an extraordinary argument. I have never witnessed or heard of an argument that was as contentious as the argument last Tuesday. And from the beginning, when the school argued its case, four of the justices, Justices O'Connor, Souter, Ginsburg, and to a lesser extent Justice Stevens, were very aggressively questioning the school district attorney, saying, you know, in essence, do you really seriously believe that you can prevail in this case? Drug testing choir students? That's odd, you know. And Rehnquist at one point snapped at Souter, cut him off about his questioning.
But they've already prevailed athletes, so is it really so odd to think it would be extended?
Well, certainly Justice O'Connor thought so, and mm-hmm. I do too. But
Justice O'Connor also voted in the minority at drug testing of athletes, so you shouldn't be surprised by that at all.
Right. Well, and Justice Ginsburg seemed clearly to be in that camp as well. And then when it was my turn to go, the first question, I believe, was from Justice Breyer. He's obviously a very important vote in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed, from the beginning seemed very much leaning towards skepticism towards my point of view, the way he phrased the question. But I felt like we were able to engage in a real extended dialogue, much more so than usually happens at oral argument, back and forth.
But if you actually look at the case and
about how it was going,
there.
And then from there, Justice Scalia had some, you know, very aggressive questioning. Ginsburg came back in, but then towards the end, Justice Kennedy had his question, which an audible gasp went up through the courtroom when he basically, as much as accused Lindsay Earls of being a druggie, and she's, you know, one of the most upstanding young women I've ever met. She's a first year student at Dartmouth now, has certainly never used drugs, and in fact did submit to a drug test and passed it, and her family was there, and when we spoke afterwards, I mean, they were shocked. They were really, I mean, it was painful for me to have to talk to them about what it felt like for them to be in the public eye.
Let me ask Julie Underwood. Julie, what do you think is the emotional backdrop to this argument in the Supreme Court?
I was probably at a different set of oral arguments than Mr. Boyd was, because I heard the questioning to be the same 6-3 vote that Vernonia.
So do you expect that the testing will again be upheld?
Yes. I think that this is very little extension from the drug testing of students in athletic activities. This is drug testing students who want to be engaged in extracurricular competition. Justice Ginsburg, in her previous opinion, was clear that she was concerned about drug testing all students. Yes, the Solicitor General's office did make comments about drug testing all students, but that is not the school board's position here. They're not trying to drug test all students. Their policy would drug test students who are involved in extracurricular competition.
Including choir, so it's not competitive in a traditional sense. Jack Beattie, I hear you there.
Those teams are competitive.
Well, of course, but you know what I mean. This isn't exactly, ice hockey. Jack?
Yeah, you know, in Vernonia, Justice Scalia's two criteria, or two of them, were the safety argument that athletes, could be endangered from what they're doing, and we need to know that they don't have dangerous drugs. But he also made another argument that athletes have less expectation of privacy, and that therefore their privacy rights, which is to mean to have someone stand behind them while they pee, that their privacy rights are less. He says school sports are not for the bashful, meaning you have to change. Well, that criterion doesn't apply to people going out for a choir. Their expectations of privacy are not set by the locker room. So it would be interesting to see whether he still applies that criterion to the new case.
I think that the case really does come down to which part of Vernonia you focus on. I mean, Scalia also talked about how the school has special responsibilities. If that's really what was behind the court's decision, then clearly I'm going to lose this case. But he also talked about how this was a school that had a discipline crisis, that had epidemic drug use, that the drug use was centered among the athletes, and that the athletes had, as you say, danger problems and lower expectation of privacy, all factors that are entirely absent for a school with low drug use, and none of it's in the choir, no danger in the choir, no privacy being lowered in the choir. So it's kind of in the eye of the beholder as to how you read Vernonia. It seems to me extraordinary to extend it, but obviously not to Justice Scalia.
We're talking about drug testing in America's schools. How widespread should it be to stop the use of drugs? Or are there larger constitutional issues here that should stop drug testing? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about drug testing in America's public schools. There's a big case before the Supreme Court. We're joined by Graham Boyd, who's arguing against drug testing in front of the Supreme Court. He's the director of the American Civil Liberties Union Drug Policy Litigation Project. And by Julie Underwood, who's general counsel for the National School Boards Association. Many of these schools, she says, want and need to use drug testing. So what do you think? What does drug testing teach American students about public priorities, about drug use, about the Constitution? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Barbara's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Huh? Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Okay. I just wanted to make the point. I understand the complexity on both sides of this issue. What I see, though, and what I'd like addressed is the problem of implementation. Mm-hmm. If this goes forward, as the trend suggests, and becomes widespread throughout our school systems, I don't feel we have anywhere near the infrastructure in place to manage that level of testing accurately and with the appropriate confidential requirements that should go along with it.
So there's confidentiality and accuracy. Our time's running down, Barbara, but let me put that, if I could, to Julie Underwood, and thanks for your call, Barbara. What about the implementation of this, Julie? Do we have the money to do it? What does it cost for each test? What about the confidentiality? What about the accuracy?
Here, it's my understanding that the tests that were used in this particular situation cost about $11 per student. And I think one of the things that may affect your caller's thinking here, this is not implementing drug testing for every single student involved in extracurricular activities on an ongoing basis, nor is it implementing drug testing of every student involved in, you know, enrolled in that public school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's random drug testing that is intermittent. The other part is certainly the privacy issue, which is very important. The drug testing that goes on in public schools certainly complies with the federal guidelines of drug testing. And in addition, you have to think about the penalties that are involved when students fail the drug test in this school and in this other schools that I know of that have implemented some form of drug testing. The penalty involved is that the student cannot participate in the extracurricular activity.
So they're quietly ushered out of choir or the chess club or whatever it may be.
Well, they wouldn't be ushered out immediately.
But I mean,
stated in that way, mm-hmm. they would not be allowed to participate
mm-hmm.
in that extracurricular activity. Those drug test results are not turned over to the police. The students are not suspended from school. The students' parents are informed, and they are removed from the extracurricular activity, and that is it.
Pradeep is on the line. Welcome, Pradeep. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
My daughter is in a private school,
okay.
And so therefore I would not be able to, you know, I have not had the exposure to talk about public schools, but I have seen a couple of things, and I do want to talk about it.
Please.
In her school, at least, also in the previous school that she where she was, basically, anything happens, you are out of the school immediately.
Students were tested for drug use and kicked out of?
No, not testing, but you know, there is some suspicion, or somebody finds out that they're, you know, the children are involved.
Okay, so it's a tough standard.
It's a very tough standard.
Mm-hmm. And are you in favor of that, Pradeep?
I'm not. I have a basic problem with this. I'm very strongly against any kind of drug testing, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we are young, we all were young one time,
yes.
And now it's the turn of our young people. And I think when you're young, you experiment with lots of different things. You always push the boundaries, and that's how also I feel that the society evolves, by pushing new corners and by creating a society in which young people would be tested, and I'm quite certain that one time or other, all these things would be created and maintained in some kind of database and so forth. So there's a major concern about the privacy issue. And I do not want my children or all other young people around me to grow up and be tagged for something that they did in their youth. And we all know that, you know, and with all our leaders and ourselves, that we have done something that we are not exactly proud of when we were young.
But you see it as part of growing up. Pradeep, our time is running down. I want to put that to Graham Boyd. It's a really important observation. Graham Boyd, I guess a couple of things. One is just about the process of growing up. On the other hand, growing up with drugs has been a real problem in American communities. And the other is this issue. Julie Underwood says this would not be reported to the police. What's the ACLU view of the strength of the privacy guarantee here?
Well, I'll tell you what happened in this Oklahoma school. Every student who tested positive, everybody in the school knew who they were. What happens is they announce over the intercom, time for you to come take your drug test, or they come to the class and take you out for the drug test. So everyone knows you've taken the drug test. And then everyone knows it takes about a week for the results to come back. So suddenly when a kid drops out of all his activities a week later, no reason is given. They don't need to post it on a bulletin board, but everybody knows exactly what happened, especially in a small school. So the confidentiality, you know, you can set all the safeguards in place you want to, but in reality, it's not even remotely confidential.
I want to get one more caller in here. Penny's on the line. Welcome, Penny. You're on the air.
Thanks. I did find that. Here's the point.
Wow, Penny, your phone's pretty tough. I'm afraid you've driven out of our zone, and I'm sorry for that. Julie Underwood, we've got to wrap up here, but your final thoughts. Do you think Supreme Court will uphold this drug testing? And if look down the road 5-10 years, how widespread do you think it will be in American schools?
I think the Supreme Court will uphold this drug testing, but I think that they will limit it to students who want to be involved in extracurricular activities. The justices talked about this as an avoidable kind of drug test.
But that's a lot of students.
Yes, it is. It is a lot of students, and we do want to keep students in extracurricular activities. But, you know, it's not part of public schools' mission or requirements to engage in extracurricular activities. So that really is a clear and logical delimiting feature.
Mm. Julie Underwood, General Counsel of the National School Boards Association, thanks for being with us tonight. And Graham Boyd, what do you think is going to happen in the Supreme Court? I know you're going to battle this thing to the end. Can you win it? And if you don't, where do you think this might end up?
I think it's too close to call how the case is going to come out. I think if the court rules in favor of drug testing and expands it beyond athletics, it's going to be an issue that every community is going to have to confront. I think what has been true before will remain true, which is most school districts will say it's expensive, it sets a bad precedent, it doesn't do any good, and therefore we're not going to do it. My fear, unfortunately, is that some people are going to be tempted. These are elected school boards for the most part, and they'll say we can look tough on drugs. That's exactly what happened in this Oklahoma school. And so just as a gesture of drug war solidarity,
they're going
to make their students the next set of victims.
Graham Boyd, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us tonight. Graham Boyd is director of the ACLU Drug Policy Litigation Project. And Jack Beatty, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Recently, the Kansas Supreme Court handed down a decision that attempted to clarify a question that on its surface could not seem more clear. What makes a man a man and a woman a woman? The court had to decide whether a marriage between a man and a person who began life as a man but changed genders through medical procedure was a legitimate union. The court ruled that the marriage was illegitimate and stated that a man who becomes a woman through surgery and chemistry is still legally a man. But for people who have undergone gender change, this legal distinction doesn't tell the whole story. Tonight we have a diary from Natasha Johnson. She was born male. When she was in her 50s, she began a transformation that she'd wanted to make for as long as she can remember. She's now living life in skirts, lipstick, and shoulder-length blonde hair, and is increasingly certain she will have the final operation to make her transformation of gender complete.
It was a wonderful family I grew up in, a lovely, wonderful neighborhood, yet inside of me was this different feeling that I came to regard, because I was Catholic, as being a sin. And in those days, I believed very much in what the Catholic Church told me. I believed there was a heaven and there was a hell. I was only a child. And I felt that I came to believe that what I was doing was kind of a sinful thing. But I couldn't stop. And of course, what was I doing? And what I was doing was this wishing to be what I wasn't. I was a little boy and I was wishing to be a little girl. And on every occasion I was dressing up in my sister's clothes, and I would lock myself in the bathroom and play at being a girl. I had lived a very exciting and interesting and adventurous life as a male. You know, I played all sports. I was a linebacker on our football team. I traveled a lot, very widely. I had many adventures. Went to war in Vietnam. I think I was very much envied by men I knew. But when I would be home on my own, yes, I would change over. And I think that with transgendered people, they need very much to be seen as females, to be taken for females, to be regarded as female. So there's a great compulsion to go out of the house and into the world. I'd get in my car, first of all. I hate to admit this, but I was so afraid of being caught, and what would happen if I was recognized or caught. To bolster my courage, I used to have to drink something. And so I would have a glass or two or three of wine and then get in my car, and I was always alone. I would drive to the shopping center, and I might go into a department store. But I was always sort of, I would always slink around. I heavens forbid that I should ever talk to anyone, because I was afraid of being discovered. I should say there was not a big wedding plan. It's not as though it was something she couldn't call, we couldn't call off. We only were married by a justice of the peace. But it was approaching, and I had to tell her. We were lying in bed together, and I told her to turn off the lights because I couldn't stay. I was too ashamed to have her look at my face, to see my face. I could only say it in the dark. Do you remember that Halloween when I dressed up as a girl and we went to that dance and I won the first prize? That's the most beautiful one there. And she said, yes. And I said, well, that wasn't playing for me. That was real. But, you know, the person I married was, I think, just cared enough for me that she stayed with me all of this time. I have taken fairly large amounts of hormones and have, you know, developed breasts. And I'm rather totally hairless now in terms of body hair. I've had electrolysis. My cheeks have been made fuller by transferring fat from my thighs into my face, into my mouth. I had a facelift. The ones I know who've had the surgery, you know, it's the most difficult thing they have to deal with, and it causes them very much pain. But it's something that they feel compelled to do. I must say that the need to be yourself is just overpowering. I just didn't want to go out of this world without experiencing this femaleness that I came into the world with, that was always inside of me, and which I kept buried inside of me for the first third and maybe two-thirds of my life. I hid it. Suddenly, at last, you're yourself. You're not running away from yourself any longer. You're not trying to escape. You can be naturally you. I had a very good life, but I've said this many times, and it's so true. As happy and as good as my life was as a male, I've never been so happy as I am now.
Natasha Johnson lives in Maine. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Are events in the news affecting you in a personal way? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point from WBUR Boston.